Welcome to Holden Village. Today, in the fabulous Fireside Room, today's speaker is Don Brandt, and he will be speaking on traditional family. So let's listen in on Don Brandt.
Many of you had a chance to skim or read the book Generations? It came out about 3 years ago, and it kind of it analyzed American history by creating this paradigm that said that we have four generational types in American society, and that every fourth generation you have a generation come that has very, very similar characteristics to a generation four generations before them. And they identified that to use the contemporary terms for the generational cycles in the 20th century, they talked about the GI generation, the silent generation that followed them, and then the baby boomers that followed them, and then the baby busters that followed the boomers. And that and when you look at those generations and talk about changes in the traditional family, I think it's fairly accurate to say that there were certain assumptions made in the case of the GI generation and the silent generation. Now, GI generation, as the term implies, is that generation impacted that typically grew up or came to adulthood in the time of the Depression, and a significant percentage of them served in the Second World War. The silent generation is the generation where early childhood was in the 30s, and we're not quite old enough to serve in the Second World War, and came of age in the late 40s and the 50s. I think it's fairly accurate to say that when it comes to the issue of family structure, that there were certain assumptions made with the GI generation and the silent generation as to family models. And that in the case of those two generations, there was kind of the norm of the two-parent household with children in American society. And that was not only true among Anglos, but also among minorities. That was kind of the expectation, the assumption, and kind of the operating model. And I think it's also fair to say that the first generation to come to adulthood that seriously questioned that model was the baby boomers. And so I'd like to kind of start from that perspective in terms of how that came about and what some of the factors were. When you look back to the formative years for boomers back in the 60s, and I just simply reflect back on my own childhood, I remember that I was born in 1951, and for me the first significant and formative public event was the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then not too long after that, and I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, of course, was significant because I remember on the way to school as a fifth grader that it had finally come to the point where, as the press was reporting that the Russian ships were still coming and Khrushchev ordered them not to turn around, and they had missiles and they were going to Cuba, and the American blockade had already been established by President Kennedy, and their orders were to board them and to insist on boarding them and inspecting them and not allowing them through the blockade otherwise. And I remember talking to a friend on the way to school and saying, how many of those Russian freighters do you think we're going to sink today? You know, but at the same time, I was kind of joking around about it. There was just a tremendous amount of anxiety. And of course, a child in the fifth grade could easily pick up on that. But of course, for adults, perhaps it was even more overwhelming. And that sense of the precariousness of life and how life is very immediate, how life can come to an end in an instant. Live for the present. Don't put off too much for the future. Don't worry about planning for your future, because life as we know it is simply too tenuous to get anxious about that. Next formative public event, of course, was the assassination of John F. Kennedy. And as a child who was very much part of that TV generation, raised on television and had unlimited access in terms of TV hours, the most impressive aspect of the Kennedy assassination for me was the idea that anything that profound, so profound and so important could happen that it would result in 3.5 days of no regular television programming. That just boggled my mind. I never knew that short of nuclear war, anything in life could happen that would be so earth-shattering that all my programs would be canceled for 3.5 days. And I sat in amazement, glued in front of that television set for that 3-day weekend. The assassination was on Friday. There was no regular television programming. I lived in Los Angeles until Tuesday. And all we had was press coverage related to the assassination, of course, later, and then, of course, Sunday morning. The first murder shown live on television was Sunday morning with Oswald. And of course, coverage through the funeral on Monday. And again, being impressed by the tenuousness of life, the instability of the world as I was growing up and coming to know it. And then, of course, as the years continued, starting in 1965 with the Vietnam conflict, and the most disconcerting year of all, 1968. Now, it looks like most of you lived through that. Can any of you recall for me there were a number of significant events in 1968? What did they include?
Woodstock.
Close, that was 69. Martin Luther's assassination.
Robert Kennedy's
assassination. Remember the timing for that. Martin Luther's assassination in April, Robert Kennedy's assassination in June. Those were very close to each other.
Invasion of Czechoslovakia
by Russia. And matter of fact, that the invasion of Czechoslovakia almost, I mean, it would have been so much bigger news story if it hadn't happened in 68. But so much, there's so much stuff happening. What else?
The Olympics and the black protests.
The Olympics were that year in Mexico City?
The
Democratic National Convention in Chicago and all the riots. And of course, don't forget the riots after Martin Luther King's assassination. That was the single, of all the years of race riots, there was never a single time, a single week, in which there were as many serious riots in as many cities simultaneously as immediately following Martin Luther King's assassination. And remember, federal troops were ordered into Washington, D.C. for the race riots that followed Martin Luther King's assassination. They were that concerned about the public buildings and, of course, the White House and the Capitol. What else?
Nixon was elected president.
Yes, and that ended up being the closest U.S. election to date. It ended up being, it ended up being closer than Nixon-Kennedy in 60, the Nixon-Humphrey. Well, anyway, Humphrey came from behind, you know, for a while they thought it was going to be a landslide, and Humphrey almost came from behind and took that one. Remember, almost every campaign speech, Humphrey, this is the big irony in the 68 convention or campaign, was that almost every campaign appearance Humphrey made, he was harassed by demonstrators, but Nixon had clear running on that one. You know, demonstrators weren't bothering the Republicans.
Promised to end the war.
But Humphrey, because of his association with Johnson.
He promised to end the war.
Who did?
Nixon did.
Right. That's right. That's right. That was his promise. And you forgot the Tet Offensive in February. The Tet Offensive in February. That was one incredible year. And I think I grew up thinking that was normal. You know. One phenomenal year. Yeah. But one thing that when we look back on all the dramatic events of the 60s, one social change that really was overlooked at the time because so much else was going on, was what was happening to the American family. Because the change, you could, I think, accurately and fairly say that the significant types of change began in the 60s when it came to the American family. And my premise here is that of all the changes in the 60s and the early 70s, in fact, the most far-reaching and the most long-term were the changes that came about to the American family. Nothing related to Vietnam, or civil rights in terms of what happened in that decade. The most far-reaching changes, I believe, are the ones that impacted the family. Marriage went, for example, during the 60s from being an expected life stage to becoming only one lifestyle option. From an expected life stage to one lifestyle option. Divorce, instead of bringing a certain amount of stigma, was in the 60s that divorce in some circles, some social circles, actually became fashionable. A 1966 issue of Harper's Bazaar described divorce as, quote, another tack of fashion, unquote. Referring to the divorced woman, the article went on, unless she botches it, divorce puts her in the driver's seat. It's almost better to have loved and lost, period, unquote. From a 1967 issue of Newsweek, quote, indeed, divorce may be evolving, at least in fashion and society pages, into something of a status symbol. In the age of the pill, the sexual revolution, and the feminine mystique, the notion that happiness takes precedence over family solidarity has clearly captured the female imagination. This was not just, I believe, and I want to make a very important point here. I'm not blaming divorce on the women's movement. because the women's movement was only one, in terms of the women's movement's approach to marriage or view of marriage, was only one part of a larger cultural change when it came to society's view of marriage. And so I'm not trying to single out the women's movement at all, just these one of those quotes, of course, referred to that. And this, so this is much more than a lifestyle change, a change in lifestyle orientation among women, far more than that. It was actually part of a very fundamental shift among both sexes regarding what is important in life. And I think all of this was triggered partly by a profound disillusionment with virtually all American institutions, and secondly, by a sense that life is so tenuous and uncertain that it is far wiser to look toward immediate gratification than it is to plan for delayed gratification. And so I think kind of the chaos of the 60s in one way contributed to that whole concept of if it feels good, do it, you know, experience it now, don't put it off until the future, because today you live, tomorrow you might not be here. But also that sense in which all institutions in American life became suspect. Started with the government, but went to education, the church, and also social institutions in American life. And so these teens and young adults coming of age in the 60s, when confronted with major issues like patriotism, duty, and family, often opted for self-fulfillment. And that became the new, I believe, the new ethic. The new ethic became self-fulfillment. Now, I'm sure that enough of us here are products of that time that we hear the term self-fulfillment and then we ask ourselves the question, well, what's wrong with that? I mean, what's wrong? Self-fulfillment sounds good. You know, in many ways, it definitely does. And there are many things and many occasions in life where self-fulfillment can become our goal, and that not only benefits us, but it benefits others as well. I mean, there are some positive kinds of self-fulfillment. But when self-fulfillment becomes an end in itself, some other things end up being put on the back burner. And we tend to make a very deliberate shift, or in some cases an unconscious shift, towards a life ethic of immediate gratification as opposed to delayed gratification. So self-fulfillment, I believe, became synonymous with immediate gratification. And traditional family obligations did not look all that gratifying, at least not in the short term. Notions like monogamy and parental responsibility represented at best delayed gratification. And consequently, these responsibilities, whenever possible, were deferred. For example, I believe that the whole yuppie phenomenon of the 80s and the focus on the professions is partly in the fact that for many people, that was the first step for both men and women prior to the family stage, was just one byproduct of that focus upon immediate gratification as opposed to delayed. So in retrospect, I believe the 60s and 70s witnessed a fundamental shift in cultural values, a shift that was aided and abetted by the media in general and, of course, television in particular. And from the perspective of living now in the 90s, we can say, I believe, and of course in my biased view with some objectivity, that perhaps the greatest casualty of that cultural shift was the traditional family. Now, what are some consequences of this shift when we look at the 90s? Well, one is that, of course, over 50% of all boomer marriages have already ended in divorce, and the projection is that of all marriages that occur in 94, two-thirds will fail. Family models also have become a little bit confused. I mean, we've got some pretty extreme examples out there. Every time I use this, I'm amazed by it. But Newsweek magazine had a short little description of an interesting family model that was developing in the life of one of the Rolling Stones. Listen to this. This is how the article actually read in Newsweek. This is 1 year old. Pay close attention. There's a quiz at the end of this item. Now you have to concentrate on this. Former Rolling Stone Bill Wyman, aged 56, is 34 years older than his ex-wife, Mandy Smith. So he was 34, they were married, they're already divorced, he's 34 years older than she is, whom he started dating when she was a ripe 13 years old. So it's no surprise that Wyman's son, Stephen, who is now 30 years old, didn't much worry about age differences when he chose a bride. The shocker is that Stephen, the son of Bill, plans to wed Patsy Smith, 46, who is the mother of his father's ex-wife. Okay? In other words, his father's former mother-in-law. So here's the quiz. What does that make Bill Wyman besides a cradle robber? Answer. The aging rocker now becomes his former wife Mandy's grandfather-in-law. And there's more. He'll be his new daughter-in-law's ex-son-in-law. And Stephen will step in as Mandy's stepfather. Now, I know that that doesn't make a whole lot of sense verbally, so I prepared an overhead. I did this for a sermon once. I thought it was really interesting. So we have here at the top of this one-generational family tree, we have Bill, aged 56 years old, who is related to his ex-spouse, Mandy, who is at this point 20, and who is father to son, Stephen, who is to be married to Patsy, who is the mother of Mandy, right? And so Bill now will become his former wife's grandfather-in-law, but Bill will also be his new daughter-in-law's ex-son-in-law, and Stephen, Mandy's former stepson, will now be her stepfather. Now, granted, that's kind of an extreme case of what's going on in American culture, or in this case, British and American culture. But I thought that sometimes it's helpful to look at the extremes to get a sense for where things are going. And to get a sense, too, for to the degree to which culture, I think we've taken tolerance now to a point where it's become self-defeating for the stability of the typical family. Some statistics. In 10 major United States cities, 10 major U.S. cities, more than 50% of all births are now illegitimate. 10 major U.S. cities. We have now reached the point where over half of all births are out of wedlock. Now, the consequences for the children are an important issue that I think that we have to address. Now, if we have time toward the end of class, we're going to spend some time just talking about this article. Now, there's a lot of angry people out there that are responding to the article, Dan Quayle Was Right, by Barbara Whitehead. And this came into the Atlantic Monthly. It was the March issue. And what was significant about this, this is not a political article. How many of you heard of the article titled Dan Quayle Was Right? Okay, about a third of you. This is not an article about politics. It's an article about Dan Quayle's bizarre dialogue with the Murphy Brown Show. Do you remember when he made the comment when Murphy Brown had made the decision to be a single mother? It wasn't being a single mother. The show was a little confused there in terms of the script. The impression you got was that Murphy Brown had the option of having the child's father, at least legally, available for a two-parent household, even though the father had a traveling job. But he wasn't all that enthusiastic. And so she decided he loved her very much and wanted to marry her, but he wasn't all that excited about the child. But Murphy Brown, in the positive sense, made the positive choice. Of course, this is so bizarre because Murphy Brown doesn't exist, but let me continue here. To her credit, she made the decision to have the child. Okay, but the point was that what Dan Quayle criticized was the fact that here's one more example of a role model for women that is stating that it is giving some people the impression that it's good for women, even if they have the option of being married, to instead decide to be a single mother. And so my sense of Dan Quayle's comment, and I'm, by the way, a lifelong Democrat, so I don't think I have Republican prejudice here. My sense of Dan Quayle's comment was that what he was criticizing was that for younger women, that somehow make an assumption that, well, if Murphy Brown did that and has a good experience, then I can certainly do that, and was perhaps a questionable role model. Well, the press just had a field day with Dan Quayle. I mean, they just ate him alive. And it's only after that the dust had settled for a while that some people like Barbara Whitehead said, well, let's wait a minute here. And let's take a look at the issue of what we have paid, what the cost has been in American culture, in our casual abandonment of the traditional family, going to the point where we, in fact, question whether or not the traditional family is all that healthy compared to alternative family models. And so Barbara Whitehead's article, which first of all, I think you'll have, even if you totally disagree with her, you'll have to admit is quite well written. This is the cover story for the Atlantic Monthly issue, and just stirred an incredible amount of dust, and got a lot of people talking. Matter of fact, partly responsible for the democratic shift, and people are questioning how sincere that is, the democratic shift now towards pro-children, and affirming traditional family model kind of platform. And some people are saying that this part of this, there's a certain hypocrisy operating there, but that the Democratic Party itself has sensed now, over the last year, a public shift in the direction towards traditional family models, that people are getting fed up with what's happening out there with the family, and that they don't want to miss the bandwagon on this one. Well, one quote, the subtitle, in fact, from Barbara's article is, quote, after decades of public dispute about so-called family diversity, the evidence from social science research is coming in. The dissolution of two-parent families, though it may benefit the adults involved, and this is an interesting part of the article, is that she was finding that a majority of adults who divorced were glad they did. Okay, even though it benefits the adults involved, it is harmful to many children and dramatically undermines our society. So that even though divorce is a positive for the adults overall, it tends to be a negative for the children. And then also, of course, perhaps even more controversially, she asserts in her article that it undermines our social fabric in a significant way. By the way, one projection is that by the year 2000, 40% of all U.S. births will be illegitimate. Now, it's now 25%. But by the year 2000, one projection is it'll be 40%. Some more statistics on this whole issue. As of 1993, 70% of all young violent offenders in long-term correctional facilities grew up without a father in the household. 70%. Now, of course, if we were going to factor in poverty, it would not be that high a percentage that would be based upon. But they've also done a study of taking violent offenders from comparable economic backgrounds, and you will always have a higher percentage that are without a father than came from a two-parent household. Quote, children from single-parent families are 2 to 3, and this is a very controversial quote, so it's not my quote, so don't jump on me for this one. But children from single-parent families are 2 to 3 times as likely as children in two-parent families to have emotional and behavioral problems. In addition, they are more likely to drop out of high school, more likely to become pregnant as teenagers, more likely to abuse drugs, and more likely to become entangled with the law. And so as these kinds of quotes and comments are coming out, we're having a pretty furious debate developing on this whole issue of family. Yet there is still a politically correct sentiment out there that ridicules the traditional family. Barbara Whitehead herself in her article mentions a bumper sticker that she saw in Amherst, Massachusetts that said, unspoken traditional family values, : abuse, alcoholism, incest, unquote. I know a bumper sticker that was saying that the traditional family is basically sick, or is more often sick than healthy, and as a result, it's not anything worth saving. An article I actually came across in Psychology Today, and this was an issue just 4 months ago that I thought was really amazing, was an interesting example of how many who would definitely disagree with Barbara Whitehead, how they're approaching this whole issue of family trends in American society. This writer insisted that the demise of the traditional nuclear family is not only inevitable, but he inferred that it's no great loss. Quote, to try to perpetuate a manifestly transient social institution, in this case the traditional nuclear family, beyond its usefulness is folly. What can we do to save the nuclear family? Very little. What should we do? Very little, unquote. So I want, and of course, that's when I get angry, is when we have that rather, I think, extremely naive assumption that the alternatives that are coming out are in fact probably better than the traditional model. And that in fact any information that we get or studies that we might question that infer that non-traditional families develop or increase the odds of children having difficulties, that tends to be thrown out partly because they feel it's inevitable and nothing can be done to save the traditional family, but and more than that, they feel that there's really no great loss when we look at the demise of the traditional family. I also came across this last year, traveling as much as I do, I actually get to see a lot more in the magazines than most people. I came across a rather fascinating article from New Woman magazine. Now, New Woman magazine's cover story in the March issue of this year was, quote, "Infidelity, the stories of real women who've led double lives for years," unquote. Now, the cover story was based upon a survey of 7,000 readers who completed the survey and returned it to the magazine. And this was identified in the magazine as the New Women 1994 Infidelity Report, which inferred it was going to become an annual custom now. They're going to do an infidelity report on an annual basis. Okay. The article opens, quote, "Your letters," this is the 7,000 responses, "your letters included stories of passion beyond your wildest dreams, stories of hope gone awry and wrecked marriages, stories of coming to life again after years of feeling numb in deadening marriages," unquote. And at no point in that article was there ever the question raised about the ethics of extramarital affairs. It just, I mean, it was the perspective of the writer of the article and apparently the editorial staff of the magazine is that we would not begin to presume that there's any kind of ethical standard that is being challenged or undermined in this issue of infidelity, but rather we simply want to report on the experiences of these people. And I think that's becoming more and more the norm in the media. That assumption that the highest value when it comes to what's happening to the family is the value of tolerance, and that we should never put ourselves in the position of presuming to infer that some family models are more appropriate and more healthy than others, because that would be very presumptuous and very judgmental for us to do that. Well, why all of this lamenting on the demise of the traditional family? It's because one of the first tasks for parents, I believe, who commit to a marriage relationship, one of their first tasks is to make that marriage work. And I believe it's even more important task if they bring children into that marriage than it is if they decide not to bring children into it. Now, first of all, I want to make my apologies to all single parents, all of those of you who have been divorced. And we want to recognize that the single parents need a tremendous amount of support. 94% of women who have been divorced in a marriage that has children end up with custody of the kids. It's a tremendous responsibility, in some cases a burden, and nothing that I say is meant in any way to criticize or to speak negatively about what has already happened in their lives. But I do believe that trying to qualify my statement, I do believe that things are getting bad enough now that we have to look seriously at the issue of preventative health when it comes to already existing and established marriages. And if that means that single people who have already been through divorce are going to be a little bit offended, then that's just going to have to be the case. That's not what I'm trying to do. What I'm trying to do is to say that we have come to the point now in terms of this American ethic of immediate gratification. We've come to the point now where some parents, some, only some, and I'm ruling out physical abuse, verbal abuse, and extramarital affairs right off the top, okay? I'm not saying keep working at those necessarily. First of all, I just rule those out. And I'm not making a judgment on all marriages, okay? Because that would be totally inappropriate. But I will say this. In some cases in American culture, couples who could work it out aren't working at it. And I wish that in some of those cases, I believe it's time for them to start saying, it's okay to work this out for the sake of the kids, period. Okay? To work at this for the sake of the kids. Now, I believe the pendulum has swung so far in American culture that it's become passé to say that. That you would say to a friend, let's say a fairly open-minded and progressive individual that's a close friend of yours, that if you were struggling in your marriage, and there's no ranting and raving going on at home, there's no physical abuse, there's no verbal abuse, but you just are not happy, things are not going well in the marriage, okay? And you just desperately strive to break out of that relationship, and to it's to the point where the easiest thing to do for you emotionally would be to have a divorce, and then just struggle with the consequences of what's going to happen to the family. I think the pendulum has swung so far in American culture that if in that kind of situation, if you sat down and you're the one in the marriage and you shared with your best friend, it's been really hard. I'm having a lot of problems with depression and a real struggle here, but I really feel we've got to work this out for the sake of the kids, that many friends would just look at you and say, you're crazy. You're absolutely crazy. Why should you stay in this marriage and be this unhappy? And I believe the pendulum has swung so far that a lot of people are saying that this wouldn't be true to yourself. You're not being honest with yourself. And you've got to put your own needs first and worry later about the consequences to the children. And so I think it's time to try to readjust that pendulum a little bit and to say that there are situations where it's worth working it out for the sake of the children. You know, I remember the first time I saw that was I was sitting at the Kinko coffee shop waiting for an order, and there was a women's magazine, I don't remember which one it was, and the editorial on the back page actually came out and said that, and first time I'd ever seen that in print in a major magazine that wasn't a religious journal, and I was pleasantly surprised, and I do believe that more and more people are taking a close look at that one. There's I don't think I brought those, did I? Oh yeah, Barbara Whitehead, she had some interesting, talk about the role models we have for relationships. Vanity Fair did a story on Jack Nicholson, and I have to admit, Jack Nicholson's one of my favorite actors, but of course I'm beginning to question that judgment now. The cover story was called Happy Jack, okay, Happy Jack. And what made Jack happy, it turned out, was no-fault fatherhood. He and Broussard, the 29-year-old mother of his children, lived in separate houses. Nicholson said, quote, "It's an unusual arrangement, but the last 25 years or so have shown me that I'm not good at cohabitation. I see Rebecca as much as any other person who is cohabiting, and she prefers it. I think most people would in a more honest and truthful world." And then, as for more permanent commitments, the man who is not good at cohabitation said, quote, "I don't discuss marriage much with Rebecca. Those discussions are the very thing I'm trying to avoid. I'm after this immediate, real thing." Now listen, I'm after this immediate, real thing. That's all I believe in, unquote. And then shortly after the story appeared, Broussard broke off the relationship with Nicholson. She probably read the story and had it at that point. But unfortunately, you know, we're in a culture where the role models are primarily sports celebrities and entertainment celebrities, and of course that's very often the kind of model that's being presented to our children. All right, let's see. We're going to have time for discussion. Just hang on. I know a lot of you are already angry and you want to say something, but I will give you a chance. Okay, there is a saying, undoubtedly you've heard it, the best thing a father can do for his children is to love their mother. And I believe that it's a saying worth repeating. Many men especially have to hear that. And I think we've got to acknowledge that, I know this is a stereotype, but there are probably more marriages out there where the man is even more responsible for the divorce than the woman. And a lot of men have got a lot to learn about relationships. Americans have been repeatedly asked in surveys, would you like to spend your life married to one other person? Would you like to spend your life married to one other person? And over 90% in surveys always say yes. And then in the same survey, the question is asked, do you expect to spend your life with one other person? And only 45% say yes. And that 45%, of course, is a pretty accurate reflection of what, in fact, will be the percentage that have one marriage in their life as opposed to going through divorce. So what does it take? How can we increase the odds that marriages work and that people, do we do it by cohabiting before marriage? Well, I think it's interesting, of course, we had this survey just within the last 2 years. First extensive survey done of couples who had cohabited before marriage to see if that increased the likelihood that their marriage succeeded. And in fact, the people that cohabited had a higher divorce rate than people that did not cohabit before marriage. So that isn't the answer. I think one of the best things, though, that I've ever read on marriage was by Tim Stafford. And he talked of the difference between seeing love as a commodity or seeing love as a decision. And he believed that the American cultural view, love is very much viewed as a commodity, it's a possession. It's kind of like as teenagers how we viewed the concept of infatuation. Love is either something you have or you don't have. You're either in love or you're out of love. And he said that what we need to present, of course, as an alternative to that view is to view love rather as a decision. And when you think about the marriage wedding vows, the pastor does not say, do you love this individual, but rather, will you? And I believe that it's fairly accurate to say that love has there's a lot that love and faith have in common. Of course, one of Billy Graham's quotes is that faith is a decision. The same is true of love. And the one thing that I remember reading that was an indicator as to whether a marriage would succeed was when couples claimed that going into the marriage, they came into the marriage with the attitude, and this isn't just one of them, this is both the bride and the groom, came into the marriage with the feeling that divorce was not an option for them. Now, granted, I've talked to plenty of people that came into a marriage with that feeling and divorced anyway, right? So I'm not saying that there's anything foolproof about that, but I'm thinking that that perhaps says something to us about the approach, the necessary and needed approach to marriage. That when couples come into the marriage saying, we don't just come in seeing if it works out, then of course we can always fall back in divorce, but rather we come into the marriage with the idea that this is a covenant and a commitment that's made for life. And I know that's easier said than done, so I don't want to be simplistic about it, but I believe that says something about the nature of what the love relationship in marriage should be. And that it's okay. I think it's finally okay if we confirm and affirm adults. And we can't do this in the case of abuse. We can't take an abused wife who comes in and confesses to us about the abusive marital relationship and say, well, you should stay in this marriage for the sake of the kids. I'm not saying that by no means. But in those situations where we have a marriage where there is some hope, I think we have to come to the point now where we willingly affirm parents that are willing to work it out, to work at it for the sake of the children. And those parents need to be supported and affirmed. Consider, of course, the well-known words of chapter 13. Now, Paul's chapter 13 in 1 Corinthians was never intended as a description of marital love, but nevertheless, it has become the most widely quoted passage. And just a few verses from this, because I want to show you what the modern translation has become. Paul's words in 1 Corinthians 13, love is patient and kind, love is not jealous or boastful, it is not arrogant or rude, love does not insist on its own way, it is not irritable or resentful, it does not rejoice at wrong, but rejoices in the right. Love bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Well, what's become the secular model? I wrote this one for a marriage sermon. The secular model is love should be exciting and thrilling, never stifling or inhibiting. It delights in freedom, not in being tied down. Love should not impede on my space, but should always free me to live to my full potential. And I think that that's perhaps a more accurate reflection of how that many people enter the marriage relationship, and a very different, of course, version than what Paul originally had. Now, for those of you who are married, some suggestions on marriage that I think we have to take seriously. There are far too many couples out there that simply are not spending time together without the kids. And that needs to end. That needs to end pretty quickly. You know, we have the whole phenomenon, of course, of empty nest divorces that are not all that uncommon. Once the children leave, the marriage relationship is no longer there. Because the investment, and you know, in some respects, of course, that there's some positive things about the fact that there becomes a certain amount of shift toward the children when children arrive. But that should never happen to the degree that the marital relationship is no longer strengthened and reinforced. And in premarital counseling, I just say to these people, I say, you've got to have at least a weekly date. You've got to have your weekly date. And if their children are already coming into this new marriage by virtue of previous families, I say it's got to be a weekly date without the children. You know, you need that time. You need that time. And movies don't count. Movies don't count. You don't communicate in a theater at a movie. It's got to be an opportunity where you're really, where you're forced. And I believe very few couples have the and I affirm couples that can do this. I can't do this quality communication normally in my house. There are always things that are calling you at home, tasks to be done. And of course, once children arrive, it's virtually, they have to be in bed, of course. But even if the kids are in bed, there are always things screaming at you at home that need to be done, tasks that are left incomplete. And so for most couples, that means you have to get out and do it. And so ideally, of course, over a meal at a restaurant, and fast food is not acceptable here. you can't communicate well over a fast food meal unless you already have that gift. And so it needs to be some place where people, you have to take the time to get the food and you actually have time to talk. So you have to make that couple time. We must not allow the parenting task to overwhelm us to the degree that we forget what it's like to be a couple. In two career families, another suggestion, in two career families, we've got to have husbands that take, and of course my wife's going to laugh when I say this, we've got to have husbands that take more responsibility at home. I've been told by a number of women about that survey, where they actually did a survey of women who had been full-time at the home, and then had gone to a full-time job outside of the home. And what they compared was the degree to which the husband took additional home responsibilities after the wife began working full-time outside the home compared to when the wife was home full-time. And the typical husband increased his workload in the house by 16 minutes per week to adjust for the wife's new full-time outside employment. 16 minutes per week. So there's some definite inequality going on here. And that's a continuous source of anger and frustration for many wives, is the fact that the husbands simply do not take that one seriously. And especially when the wife is working outside of the home. You just can't get away any longer with saying that's the woman's job. I mean, they're just not, it's not true, it was never true, and they're definitely not gonna accept it in 1994. And I see it in many marriages that's the communication breakdown is far more primary than this. But I see in many marriages this situation of totally unequal response, a division of responsibilities, both in terms of the parenting role and household responsibilities. I see this as a continuing force, a source of irritation and long-term anger on the part of the wife. And whereas when husbands really put out a lot of effort to make that more fair, it's definitely appreciated. Let's see. And two problems. How do I sit down? Oh, for single divorced parents. What's primary in that kind of a situation is to not allow, of course, the children to become caught in the middle of the conflict. And I know that's easier said than done, and I have not been through a divorce, so I can't speak from experience on this. But it's amazing how even in a relatively amicable divorce, it is so easy for the children to be put in a situation of being expected somehow to take sides in the new arrangement. And that can be done so subtly. I mean, that putting the child in that position can be as subtle as making just a very relatively innocent criticism about the child's other parent. And so let's say it's the father coming and getting the child for a weekend, and they go off and they go out and they have a good time. And even one or two negative comments about the ex-wife in the course of that weekend puts that child in a terribly unfair situation and has to be avoided at all costs. You can never vent to your children about your anger regarding your ex-spouse. You do not have that right. I don't care how important you think it is to be honest and open and upfront, you do not have that right. That anger has to be reserved for another party. You cannot put your children in that situation. Divorce is hard enough on kids without it being complicated by that kind of abuse. Okay. So it's very important. In terms of the remarriage into a step family, there has to be an incredible amount of patience in any expectation for children to be comfortable in a new step family arrangement. You've got to give them a tremendous amount of freedom to slowly adapt and get comfortable with that new living situation, and realize that for some children, they will never, never feel as much a part of the step family as they felt they were a part of their original family of origin. And so to be very tolerant and understanding, and to lower your expectations perhaps to some degree as to how happy they ultimately are going to be with that arrangement. And so don't underestimate how tough it is for the children in that setting. And if you do remarry and have custody of the children, the best strategy is wait until the right person comes along before you marry again. Again, for the sake of the children. Because that really complicates their lives to have to go through that a second time. You know, and there's always a risk when we talk about marriage like this. I just did a sermon on this some family issues. I noticed a teenage girl out there with tears in her eyes. And I found out after the service that she's in her third family. Her third family is a teenager. And she was almost identifying too much with what she was hearing. So please, let's try to be as compassionate as we possibly can to make it as easy as we possibly can in those situations where there really is no recourse. And one last thing on boyfriends and with either if the woman has custody or the man has custody, the issue of live-in boyfriends. I've become a raving traditionalist on this one. If you're in a situation where there's been a divorce, I do believe in almost all cases it is totally inappropriate and unhealthy to expect your kids to become used to live-in spouses or live-in significant others that you are not intending to marry in the very immediate future. Because that's just, there are so many kids now that are going through this revolving door with the romantic partners for their parent. After having been in a family with their birth father and birth mother, now having to deal with a household where different boyfriends are coming through the house to live, I think it's just extremely, potentially it's dangerous, by the way, in terms of abuse, much higher risk, much higher odds for abuse for the children. But even apart from that, assuming you have just the neatest people come through, that's very, very difficult for the kids to adjust to. Okay, and so let's, to open up discussion, we have here, we've got 15 minutes. I'd like to start with the discussion question of what do you think about the concept of working at a marriage for the sake of the children? How does that either bother you or feel right to you? And I realize for some of you that's probably going to bother you because you see some potential dangers in that. So let's open it up. Who wants to jump in here? Yes?
I will. I came from a divorced family. And they did try a couple of times to work it out, and it just wasn't to be, I suppose. And I felt that it was much better for them to separate at the time because the three of us children were pitted one against the other. We didn't know which side of the fence to fall on. And it was bickering and arguing, and there was alcohol.
Okay.
And we were much happier being a single parent family.
There was
much bitterness between the two parents too.
What were your ages when the divorce actually finally happened?
Probably 8, 10, and 15.
Okay. And you were which one?
I'm in the middle.
You were the 10-year-old. So you felt in your situation it was just preferable
it was the
to having
way to
stay
go.
Together. And so there was substance abuse on the part of one of your parents?
Yes.
Okay.
And physical abuse as well.
There was physical abuse as
yes.
well? Okay. I should have added substance abuse to my list. I had physical abuse. I should have added substance abuse to my list in terms of those situations where we have to be very, very patient.
But even if there's not abuse or substance abuse, I mean, how healthy can it be for children to live under the roof with people who are just cohabitating some kind of dead existence just, quote unquote, for their sake? I mean, I don't think that that's necessarily healthy for the children either.
Yeah.
I mean, there's more to a marriage than living under the same roof. And if the marriage is dead, trying to make some pretense out of it for the sake of the children, I think is probably more harmful than just demonstrating to children that when something is wrong, it needs to be fixed. And if fixed means leaving the marriage, then that's...
How does fixing it, how do you fix it by leaving the marriage?
I mean, if the marriage is dead, you know, if people are just cohabitating and living some kind of miserable existence, you know, that's not demonstrating good health to the children.
Yeah. Now, I'd be willing to argue with you on that one. And I suppose my first response would be, well, how would you define a dead marriage? I mean, you know, for example, when does a marriage come to the point? Let's assume there's no substance abuse, physical abuse, verbal abuse, or whatever else I mentioned, or no extramarital affairs. At what point do we determine that the marriage is beyond hope?
Well, I mean, that's the catch to it. But, I mean, you know, just for example, I mean, there are people who, I think, stay in a household who have no interaction or no dialogue. They're just kind of leading separate, desperate lives and going their own way. And, you know, children pick up on that. They pick up on the loss of love.
Right. Right. And so the question then is, what is more difficult for the children to adjust to? Staying in that or adjusting to the divorce? And I think we have to look at the question of whether we've tended over the years to undermine the emotional consequences of divorce to many children. You know, it's the only long-term study of children from divorced homes was one that came out just a few years ago. And one interesting finding of that was that as these children who had by this time become adults were interviewed, were tracked and then interviewed as adults. And so we're talking about all the divorces were somewhere between 10 and 20 years in their past. Almost every one of the people followed in this study said they would have preferred, in retrospect, if their families had remained intact. Now, they didn't. We don't know to what extent they thought that was a possibility or feasible, but they would have preferred, given what they went through, they would have preferred if the families had remained intact.
But they don't know that. All they know is what they did go through. You haven't interviewed,
right.
You haven't interviewed the people that have come out of dead marriages.
That's true. But I'm just trying to give that one side of the coin there, kind of in response to your side, is to realize there is that other side, too. The other side that says, yes, but you can't always forecast the consequences of divorce on a child. And we can't always assume that what we have here, given the difficulty we're having keeping this marriage together, we can't always assume that this is worse than what that will be. Okay, that's my only thought.
The other issue, you know, as a pastor, you always get involved in these settings, and there are those that know that really divorce is the best option. But I guess after a few years in ministry, I was amazed at the divorces and the separations that were occurring over things that were very salvageable and workable. And it comes back to this whole instant gratification or instant society or throwaway society, you know. It just blew my mind that it would spend more money on lawyers and those kinds of items as opposed to marriage counseling or patience and listening and developing those kinds of skills.
And of course, you know, one thing I want to throw in is that every marriage takes two people to make it work. For example, you often have a marriage situation where one wants to work, where the classic example is, counseling is recommended, one says yes and one says absolutely not. And I mean, that a very important corner has been turned at that point. One person, more often the husband than the wife, but more as we go through the years, more getting closer and closer to 50-50, but still more often the husband than the wife, one person says, I'm not interested in counseling, either we don't need it, it's not important enough, or it won't help, whatever the reason.
Or can't afford it.
Or I can't afford it. And then the corner has been turned at that point. The other partner then has been served notice, really in a pretty official, public way, I don't think we need to work on this, or I don't think it's salvageable. And at that point, it's understandable if the one that wants counseling says, there's not much hope for this marriage, because I'm dealing with a partner here that really is not willing to put any kind of investment in the relationship.
It's not so much the problem, really, we as individuals in society are not teaching our children what marriage is and how to go about it. You know, to me, a lot of these other things are after the fact of marriage.
That's true.
Where we, those are still issues that need to be dealt with, but so much of the problem, I think, is through the media and us in society, have failed to teach people what marriage is about, and they have false expectations of marriage.
Right. And to what extent we're modeling in inappropriate kinds of marriage relationships, yeah.
I mean, to me, that's where the problem really is.
Well, the problem is the consequences of what happens now, of course, go right into the next generation. And there's one thing I think it would be pretty easy for us to come to some sort of agreement on is that there is a residual effect. I mean, we're talking about kids from divorced homes tend to approach marriage from a more pessimistic viewpoint in terms of the likelihood of their marriage being lifelong. I think that would be fairly easy to substantiate. And there's something, and there is a relationship between your expectation, between first of all, your hopes for marriage, and secondly, what in fact ends up being the end result. But anybody else? I know a lot of you want to make comments. And jump in. Yes, Jim.
I would just add another, for me it's a sign of hope when some of the bestsellers, Giving the Love You Want, Harville Hendricks, some of those books are out there that I think are taking seriously the work of marriage and normalizing stages of disillusionment and unhappiness and long periods of struggle and work. I don't know what that's saying as a society, but I take some encouragement from that as someone who works with couples all the time. Of course, I'm at the event where couples come to me to work on their relationship, so I'm very thankful to be in that position. But I would see that as a sign that the society is searching for ways of understanding realistically the business of making things different, making things better. Mm-hmm. Plus, so much of the popular self-help stuff has a focus on self-change versus finding the right person or finding the right mate,
yeah,
being the right mate,
right,
and dealing with one's own issues. And I think all that works together, works well for certainly for the emotionally to the children.
We could spend a whole hour talking on how the Hollywood mystique on love has negatively impacted the institution of marriage. I mean, since the 30s, that whole concept that the Hollywood definition for love is essentially infatuation and immediate gratification and a tremendous emotional experience. And so when you grow up in a culture that lifts up that model for love, obviously it's so difficult to deal with the disillusionment of a lifelong relationship that almost inevitably comes.
How do you find the right person? I feel fortunate in that I found the right person, but I can name on one hand three or four people that the couples that I know have been in different marriages thinking that that was the one for them and it didn't last.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not sure I'm comfortable with the question.
I know there is no menu, no set procedure, but on the other hand, you really don't know anyone either until you've lived with them for a while.
Yeah.
I don't agree with living together before marriage.
Mm-hmm.
So,
there are a few. There are some things you can suggest. For example, you can really encourage relatively long courtships, and I think there is. The danger signs come up to me. Now, of course, it's interesting. I was just reading, there was an LA Times article 6 months ago that was talking about, and I thought this was really unfair that they did this because it's not a very good message to be giving to the public. But they were talking about those people who had, movie celebrities that had met somebody and gotten married within weeks of the time they met them as total and complete strangers. And part of the problem is that just feeds, I think, the cultural misnomer that Ms. Right or Mr. Right are out there, and if you find the person, you'll know by the overwhelming sheer impact of this the dynamism, the magnetism that'll come between you, and you just know that's it. And of course, there I think it can be substantiated that the shorter the courtship, when it comes to really brief courtships, the more likely we're talking about a relationship that won't last. So one thing we have to really, and of course in the AIDS era, this is becoming really complicated. To have to encourage kids to do with long courtships at the same time that sex is becoming such a dangerous pastime. So it's not just an ethical concern now with sex. There's a real physical health issue involved. But they do need to take their time. But the longer you know somebody, the less likely you're going to have significant surprises in marriage.